sprinkles a pinch of tobacco into the dancing flames of a spirit fire in the inner city of Minneapolis. Dozens of community members gather as an act of resilience in the wake of federal Operation Metro Surge.
We learned from our elders, our old ones, like the founders of the American Indian Movement in 1968, that we come together in time of need.
Crow Belcourt is of the Bad River Chippewa Tribe and the executive director of the Indigenous Protector Movement, who has partnered with All My Relations Arts, Powwow Grounds, and the Native American Community Development Institute, or NACDI, to stage a hub for community members and trained observers on the streets of Minneapolis.
We have cars pulling up by the truckloads, dropping off supplies, food, diapers, wood.
Angel Swan is a citizen of the White Earth Band of Ojibwe and operations director of NACDI.
When you get onto this property, the energy shifts, and it's not so scary anymore when you're with a group of people, and you need the laughter through this really hard time.
The Indigenous Protector Movement is still accepting food, snacks, firewood, and non-perishable goods at 1414 East Franklin Avenue in Minneapolis. For Minnesota Native News, I'm Deanna Standing Cloud.
In our final story, Jazz Wagner brings us to Heritage Hockey Night, where families celebrate culture, language, and community.
The scent of sage and the sounds of drumming filled the cold air in Virginia on January 20th as the puck dropped between the Rock Ridge Wolverines and the Cloquet Lumberjacks. Gordon Majiganeash Jourdain leans into the microphone to deliver an exciting play-by-play in Anishinaabe moment.
Hockey is an action-oriented game, and Ojibwe lends itself as a perfect language to describe what they're doing because it's an action-oriented language.
Gordon Jourdain is a first language Ojibwe speaker and announced a Minnesota Wild game, the first game ever broadcast in Ojibwe language. Maria Potterzay is the Indigenous Director for the Rock Ridge Public Schools. She organized the special two-night Native American Heritage Hockey Nights. The first of two nights featured a girls' hockey exhibition game. The game was broadcast live in Ojibwe Mo'en on KBFT Boise Fort Tribal Radio, Misabi Community TV, and streamed online at the Rock Ridge YouTube channel.
We do have another event coming, and that is the boys varsity hockey game. And we predict that that event is going to be packed because that is our biggest rival.
That game will take place on January 30th at the Iron Trail Motors Arena and will also be broadcast in Ojibwe. For Minnesota Native News, I'm Chaz Wagner.
Minnesota Native News is produced by Ampers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, made possible by funding from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and the citizens of Minnesota.
The viewpoints expressed in this program are the opinions of the people expressing them and are not necessarily those of Fresh Air Incorporated, its staff, or its board of directors.
Bonjour, hello, welcome to Native Lights, where Indigenous voices shine. I'm your host, Leah Lem. Today, we're revisiting our chat with Allison Herrera. Allison is an Indigenous Affairs journalist and author. In our conversation, Allison talks about her journey into becoming a reporter. At the time of our chat, she was with APM Reports, and we had just worked together on a story about Leonard Peltier's prison sentence commutation. Allison has since started a JSK Journalism Fellowship at Stanford University in California. Please enjoy our conversation from March 2025.
Have a really non-traditional path to journalism in that I didn't go to journalism school. I decided that I wanted to be a reporter because I got my start at KFAI. I really wanted to explore Indigenous history in the state, particularly in the Twin Cities. I didn't really hear a lot of that on any other station, and so I wanted to pioneer that. I thought that was really important.
Bonjour, hello, welcome to Native Lights, where Indigenous voices shine. I'm your host, Cole Primo.
And I'm your other host, Leah Lem. Miigwech for joining us. Native Lights is more than a podcast and radio show. At its core, it's a place for Native folks to tell their stories. Each and every week, we have captivating conversations with great guests from a bunch of different backgrounds. Musicians, artists, doctors, community leaders, healthcare advocates, you name it. We have a great mixture of passions, and we talk to them about their gifts and how they share those gifts with their community. And it all centers around the big point of purpose in our lives. And can't wait to continue amplifying Native voices today. Cole, how are you doing?
Doing great.
Excellent.
It's been a minute since we've recorded a session here, so I'm excited to get back into it. Ready to go. How are you doing?
I'm great. As you will notice, because you can see me.
Yeah.
I'm in a redone office space.
Yeah.
I spent many hours painting and moving furniture. I got a new rug. You know when you actually put art up on the walls?
Oh, yeah.
It feels really good. There's art up on the walls, so I feel very accomplished. And yes, it is in the style of Lord of the Rings, Gandalf inspired. I'm looking at Lord of the Rings art right in front of me. I painted a lonely mountain that's up on the wall. There's a bunch of stuff around. Just trust me. I have a dragon hook.
Nice. Got
over
it.
On the wall. This is a lot of little touches that remind me of Middle Earth whenever I look around.
Living the dream.
Mm-hmm. I said, why not?
Glad you finally made it, you know. And looks great. Awesome. Well, how about let's get at it, huh?
All right. Right into it.
Let's get going.
Well, I'm really excited today. We're talking with Allison Herrera. Allison is an expert Indigenous affairs journalist. Her Indigenous ties are from her Holon-Silinan tribal heritage, and her family's village is in the Toro Creek area of the Central California coast. She's currently a reporter with APM Reports, and I have the opportunity to work with her from time to time. She has a really long bio, so I'll let her take care of that when we get to it. Allison is here with us now. Bonjour, Allison.
My mother's name is Margaret Lunt or Margaret Herrera. My grandmother was Anna Herrera, and she was born in Templeton, California. And then most of her family lived in the Toro Creek area between Atascadero and Morro Bay in California. And I'm really happy to be here. So thank you so much.
Awesome.
Thank you, Allison. We always like to ask, how are you? How's the family?
My family's doing pretty good. I mean, my daughter right now is at work. This is her final year of high school, so she's a senior at Roosevelt. And she is currently just deciding where she wants to go to college. And so that's a really big deal. That's a really big transition in her life, a transition in our relationship, and a transition in, you know, how I think of myself as a mother and a caretaker and my relationship with my daughter. My mom lives in Redding, California, and she is in her mid-70s. The last I spoke with her, I sent her some coffee and Joan Baez's book of poetry, which I'm very excited to get. I have two sisters and I have a brother, and they're all younger than myself, and they do various different things. And I have two really funny and very cute nephews that live in Seattle.
Thank you. And sometimes we like to start off our conversations a little light, a little lighter. If there's anything you're concentrating on or thinking about these days or geeking out perhaps about anything.
You know, I really love Oklahoma Indigenous history, and I am reading this book. It's called The Ghosts of Crook County. My friend Russell Cobb, who is a historian and a journalist, wrote this book about this man named Charles Page, who is the founder of this small town in Tulsa County, right outside of Tulsa in the Muscogee Nation, called Sand Springs. And he ran a home for widows and orphans that he started at the turn of the 20th century. He was a Pinkerton agent, detective, and then he moved to Oklahoma during the oil boom and made his fortune, you know, discovering oil on Muscogee Creek land. And then the book is about his relationship with this woman named Minnie Atkins, which was this Muscogee woman, and how he forced her to lie and say that she had a son named Tommy Atkins. So the whole book kind of revolves around whether this son of hers really existed and the tale of that and like his scheming to get part of that allotment land. So,
Well, it sounds like you can get immersed in the universe of the time with writing like that.
He's a really colorful writer, And where one reader or writer might think like, oh, we didn't need to include this stuff about the Kerr glass factory, he sees everything as like really important and puts it into the book.
All right. So let's take a journey through your bio. Can you talk about some of your experiences?
I have a really non-traditional path to journalism in that I didn't go to journalism school. I decided that I wanted to be a reporter because I got my start at KFAI, which is the community radio station in Minneapolis. And I was really drawn to just the eclectic mix of music and personalities, however exhausting they may be there at KFAI. I mean, really a great station. And the news department I worked in was Ann Alquist, and she really just taught me how to cut tape and do interviews and voice my script. And so I just was really drawn to it, and I just decided I'd like to give it a try. And so I started volunteering in the newsroom, where I covered all kinds of things like elections, school board meetings, movies, all kinds of things. And then I started working for AMPERS, actually, you know, for the Association of Minnesota Public and Educational Radio Stations. I worked in MN90, Minnesota History in 90 Seconds. I worked for Twin Cities Public Television, and I worked for TPT and the show called Minnesota Original as their like communications, like out community outreach person. My passion is really for journalism and radio, and the work that I did at MN90 was just really interesting, like to have to be able to condense what could have been a 5 to 10 minute piece about Minnesota history into 75 seconds. I worked on Minnesota Native News, also for AMPERS, and I think it was like in its first iteration of that. And then, you know, when the Legacy Amendment passed, there was a lot of funding to do projects that revolved around Minnesota history and culture. And, you know, at KFAI, I really wanted to explore Indigenous history in the state, and particularly in the Twin Cities. I didn't really hear a lot of that on any other station. And so I really wanted to pioneer that. I thought that was really important. I worked for The Uptake, covering the Minnesota State Capitol, which was also fun and exhausting. But, you know, for the most part, like really exciting to be stationed at the Capitol with all these other reporters, you know, from WCCO to NPR to the Star Tribune to all these places, and like get to be in the scrum and like live stream Governor Mark Dayton's press conferences and like scurry around and try to get interviews and stuff. And so I was the editor for the Twin Cities Daily Planet for a hot minute before I started going down to Oklahoma, which is where I really feel like my reporting career really kicked off. And that was in 2015. I got this opportunity through Association for Independence in Radio, or AIR, to do this project called Local Lore. What they did was they paired reporters with a radio station, and it was a national project to do a combination of reporting, community engagement, and to just do something that the station had really wanted to do but never had the funds or the chance to do. And so I remember I wanted to do a project with Boys Fort Tribal Radio, but the organizers of AIR was like, there's this station in Oklahoma, this NPR station in Oklahoma, that really wants to do more reporting on Native communities because Oklahoma has 39 tribes, 38 federally recognized tribes, and they don't have somebody to do that. And you've been doing that here in Minnesota. And so I went down there and I got to work with Sterling Harjo. He had his own production company, and we made a series of short documentary films together about different people and subjects in Oklahoma. And I was just at the station and I got to meet all of these people and go to all of these places and received this really warm welcome down in Oklahoma, covering everything from free press in Indigenous media to water rights in Southeast Oklahoma, just meeting really incredible people. And I never thought I would want to move down to Oklahoma. But I think the moment I stepped off the plane the next day when I was walking around, I just was like, oh, this place, this feels like home. Like I really enjoyed being there. And then when my 9-month project ended, I was so sad. I don't want to stop coming here. And I just didn't.
You're listening to Native Lights, where Indigenous voices shine. Native Lights is produced by Minnesota Native News and AMPRS with support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Today, we're revisiting our chat with Allison Herrera, Indigenous Affairs journalist and author. At the time of our conversation, she was with APM Reports. She has since started a JSK Journalism Fellowship at Stanford University. How do you describe Native journalism, the role of Native journalism, or reporting on Native communities in the United States now? How do you view that?
It's a lot about listening, and it's a lot about relationships. If you really want to tell a good story, if you really want to have people that trust you or have people that want to talk to you, I think how media has framed Indigenous stories in the past has been very harmful and very detrimental. And I'm not saying that like it's all better now. It's an ongoing conversation. And I think it's also one that sometimes doesn't fit within the confines of what we think is like, you know, the institution of journalism, which is a white institution. It's about carving our own space in that, especially now because we are in the midst of this really big upheaval in the federal government. And I think the way that we are able to tell the story about how federal cuts and downsizing is impacting communities and is impacting the trust relationship is really important. As Indigenous journalists, we're in a unique position to talk about that. You know, you go into another community and it's about showing respect and not being the person who like knows everything and is the expert, which is kind of like the opposite of what we are taught as journalists in the institutions that we work in. There will always be a tension between what we do in our circle in Native news and the larger newsroom. I do think that. So.
There's a different approach too. I don't feel like we are the center of the story in its telling. It's like, I feel more of my job is to push things aside or obstacles aside and make space for the stories that need to be told instead of trying to be the star, the person who's like doing the telling. I'd much rather hear from people who are living their stories than trying to retell a story. But what drew you to journalism?
Well, I really like documentary filmmaking. That was a big draw. And I guess also, you know, hearing my grandmother talk, I recognize like she just had a lot to say. And I feel like I spent my whole life trying to drag the truth out of her about what, like our own history. I think just from a young age, I was just like really curious about her and her life and the life of our people and my great-grandmother and her relatives. And that's a story I still am telling and want to tell in a bigger way. I guess also drawn to a sense of if you say something true against something that's a lie, that there's a sense of justice about it, right? Like you can correct it, you can make it right, you can make a change. I still think that even though I feel sometimes that our industry lacks some empathy and compassion, and I think that sometimes we get things wrong, I still believe in the power to tell a truth against a lie and make things right. And in particular, when it comes to reporting in Indian country, I think that's really important.
What would you say drives your work? Are there any experiences you'd like to mention that have kept you on your path?
I think about my grandmother and I think about her family and her story. And I think that's a really big motivator. I work on other stories, but then from time to time, I pick that one back up and I work on it a little bit. You know, I was talking about that book I'm reading. It's also just about when you drive in Oklahoma, there's just no way to not see that place as through a Native lens, through just the people that you meet, through the turnpike that you drive down, through the dusty roads that you go through. And all that is just such a draw. Oh, I get to, you know, go down to, you know, Okmulgee or Henrietta today, or I don't know, like
the power of connecting with people to tell their story. Or like a few weeks ago, I did this, maybe a month ago now, I did this story about this basketball team in Minneapolis, the Red Bears basketball team. And I just fell in love with those kids on the team and like their coach and their commitment to making this sport that is really trying to transform people's lives. And then last fall, the story that I did about the former felons who got the right to vote, they deserved a second chance. And I'm getting off topic, but I think Native people are like the treaty making and the foundation of our country is because of Native people. Like the United States was just this struggling, like adrift country, and they needed us. They needed us to form this democracy. And I don't ever want to let them forget that. You know, I don't ever want to let anybody forget. And I think that is one of the biggest drivers, you know. And I think that all of those things that I talked about, from telling the story about my grandmother and her family to all of these other stories that I do, are all fit into that fabric, fit into this quilt. And then other people's stories also fit into that as well.
Thank you so much. So you mentioned your grandmother. Are there other people you'd like to acknowledge that have helped you along the way, mentors?
Well, my mom, obviously, and my friend Ziva Brandstetter, who is the editor for Ed ProPublica. She was a really big inspiration for me. I mean, my uncle Frank, my aunt Leona, and my uncle George, who live in Hawaii. I mean, I love all of my aunts and uncles very deeply, but my family, like, really helped take care of me and like helped take care of my brother and sisters. I just want to acknowledge them and how much I love them and that I miss them and that I wish that I could just take a month off to go and visit all of them right now and leave my work behind, but I cannot.
Awesome. You work in both radio and print. Is there a preferred medium, or is it refreshing not to be pinned down to one or the other?
It's refreshing not to be pinned down, you know? And it's all about, like, I think just getting, I mean, radio is really great because it's ephemeral. You know, people turn on the dial and they listen to it or they listen to it online. And I think that that's really exciting. But, you know, I mean, digital is also really immediate, right? Like you put it up there, people read it, it's out there, you know? So I don't know. I don't like to be tied down to one or the other.
And what amazes me about you is that you go between Oklahoma in Minneapolis. What is it, like every other week?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I do drive and it's a little insane. It's about 10 and a half hours and I go down 35 and I go through Iowa. I go through Missouri. I think by the time that I hit the Will Rogers Turnpike in Oklahoma, it's like, oh my God, it's almost over.
Oh my gosh. Do you get work done driving?
Yeah. I mean, I interview people or I'll take phone calls, or like that one Sunday when we were waiting for the Peltier release, like, okay, this is not safe and please do not ever do this. But I was slacking you, checking my email while I was driving down I-35, which was very dangerous. And don't drive that at home.
Just feel free to call me whenever. Don't worry about text or Slack.
I know. And on top of that, that was like Biden's last full day in office. So I was listening to these Martin Luther King celebrations to see if he was going to say something about Peltier. So I was like, you know, trying to pay attention. And then I was also refreshing the White House press announcements page because I thought, okay, you know, it's going to be here. Like, and then I'm going to have to pull over. I mean, I have definitely filed from the road many times. Like, putting the coat over my head in the car and filing the thing. It's not ideal, but it gets the work done. Yeah. So
I was going to ask about, you know, how it was covering the homecoming event in North Dakota.
I mean, it was electric. You know, he was, like I think I said in my story, he was still very defiant. I mean, I think he has still a long list of grievances against the Bureau of Prisons that he's not really going to let go of. And rightfully so. Like, you know, I was actually just texting with his lawyer about an hour ago, and he told me that he had a 2-hour conversation with him over Zoom. And they were talking about, you know, his health and like,
you know, whether he can file suit against the Bureau of Prisons. But yeah, it was exciting to be there. I mean, like, I, you know, grew up as a young girl hearing about Leonard Peltier. That was my introduction to, like, Indian journalism and activism, was, like, hearing about his case. He had not done it, you know, and then just following that. And I never thought I would ever get to interview him. Right? It was just crazy. Yeah, I mean, it was very exciting. And I look forward to our interview with him and asking him about his life and how his view towards activism has changed, and about his family, and if he's had any time to reflect on the American Indian movement that he's been in prison, and if he's ever considered, you know, if he's ever wanted to criticize some of their actions, as I think over the years, people's understanding of AIM, I think that people have leveled some criticism at the American Indian movement over the years. And I'm just curious to hear his take on it, you know, being in prison and everything. So
you're going to be interviewing him?
Yeah, I put in my request. And so if anybody from the Sunshine Sachs Press Agency hears this interview, just know that I've got my book that I'm reading. I've got everything. So
you're listening to Native Lights, where Indigenous voices shine. Native Lights is produced by Minnesota Native News and AMPRS with support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Today, we're revisiting our chat with Allison Herrera, Indigenous Affairs journalist and author. At the time of our conversation, she was with APM Reports. She has since started a JSK Journalism Fellowship at Stanford University. Now, I was going to ask if you wanted to talk about tribal justice, the struggle for Black rights on Native land at all.
Yeah, I just finished this podcast. It's an audiobook for Audible, and it's called Tribal Justice, the Struggle for Black Rights on Native Land. And it's about this man named Michael Hill. He is a Cherokee citizen, but he doesn't have what's known as blood quantum. Cherokee Nation, just to be clear, their tribal citizenship is not dependent on a blood quantum. It is dependent upon whether you can find an ancestor on the Dawes Rolls that is Cherokee. So he is a Cherokee freedman, but he's a Cherokee citizen, and he got in trouble. He was arrested on his own property within the Muscogee Nation in 2020, and this was right after the McGirt decision that handed back jurisdiction to the Muscogee Nation, and then as a result, several other tribes to be able to prosecute crimes on their own reservation. But because the state court refused to transfer the jurisdiction, transfer his case over to the Muscogee Nation because he doesn't have a blood quantum. The story is about the history behind that and belonging and race and how that factors into when a criminal court can make this decision based on this older decision from almost 200 years ago about who is and who isn't a Native person in the eyes of the law. And I just found that to be such a fascinating and, like, terrible thing if you're living through that. And so I just, myself and my producer, Adriana Rodriguez, we chronicled his case and his, and what happened to him and why it happened and what people are doing to remedy that, so that he can have his case tried in Cherokee Nation Tribal Court. The reason why that's so important is because as tribal nations gain, you know, as they've had jurisdiction returned, I think there's more of a push to have more, like, holistic justice rather than just be very punitive. And he felt like he was robbed of that chance.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot to learn there, a lot of history to learn.
Yeah. Yeah, you can check it out on audible.com. Yeah, I'm really proud of that. I'm really excited about that and glad that people are interested in that and interested in that history.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you don't hear about it.
No. Uh-uh.
I didn't hear about it before listening.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for your time. We would like to end the conversation by just asking if you had any final thoughts, anything left that you'd want to mention, whether it's, you know, advice for people who might be pursuing a similar path or whatever. Final thoughts.
Okay, I have this sign that I wrote at the beginning of the year that says, "Don't go backwards, let it go." And that's a reminder to myself to, like, I guess maybe in another way to say, don't hold on to things. And I think that's really important now, to be able to